You want long-term economic policy problems? We've got long-term economic policy problems on the program today. Also, some fun stuff from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday today, April 27th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I am just going to posit here as we get going that anytime a key economic indicator comes framed as that's the lowest it's been since the Great Depression, you are losing out the gate. And that is where we find ourselves with the American labor pool, otherwise known in the news stories of the past day or so as the results of the 2020 census. Our population growth is slowing. You've heard the number, just 7.4% growth over the past decade, the lowest since the aforementioned Depression. And that's just bad economically. Fewer young people and people in their prime working years, fewer working age immigrants, all trying to support more baby boomer and eventually, yes, millennial retirees. These are, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports to get us going, just some of the headwinds of our economic future.
Beneath the slow population growth numbers is this showstopper.
For the first time in U.S. history, the working age population is actually shrinking.
That's labor economist Gad Levinon at the Conference Board. He says it's especially tough in the Northeast and Midwest. So companies there will take their jobs and their factories and leave.
The center of the population is shifting to the South Atlantic and to the West. So in terms of like where do you position your plants is moving in those directions as well.
Meantime, baby boomers are retiring and living longer, straining government budgets. And it doesn't help that the birth rate has fallen to 1.7 births per woman. Independent economist Diane Lim says would-be parents fret about the cost of childcare and college.
Those two burdens, they loom large in Americans' decisions to have children because it takes a lot of money to raise a child to be able to afford to move into a school district that is a high-quality school district.
There are winners in a slow-growing America, notably young women having those fewer children. Olivia Mitchell directs the Pension Research Council at the Wharton Business School.
They will be able to invest in their education and skills and earn higher wages over a longer working life.
How to respond to the change in demography? For government, Mitchell says the answers include more immigrant workers and raising the retirement age, both politically dicey. Businesses are filling worker shortages with remote workers and with machines. And some are adapting to the reality of older employees.
In fact, in Germany, there are BMW plants that have already been completely reconstructed and reconfigured so that older employees can remain on the job with more robotic assists.
That's what you need to do to grow and stay competitive when your population is aging and barely growing. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A very quick nod to history as we move on. We're going to hear from Jay Powell tomorrow on the state of this economy. And I'm going to guess there aren't going to be any census questions for the Fed chair, but what do I know? Powell's press conference tomorrow, as the Fed wraps up one of its regular meetings, will come a year and a day, which makes today the day 10 years ago that then-chair Ben Bernanke held the Fed's first ever press conference. Maybe I am unreasonably excited by that marker, but hey, it's my job, you know. On Wall Street today, traders clearly unmoved by history. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We all learned a whole lot, and we learned it real fast, about how fragile global shipping can be when that giant container ship got stuck in the Suez Canal last month. Still there, by the way, the Ever Given is. It has been floated, yes, and the canal is clear, but the ship has been impounded by the Egyptian government, pending payment of almost $1 billion to make up for fines and some lost revenue. But anyway, inshore navigation is hardly the only problem the shipping industry is dealing with these days. Bloomberg did a little bit of digging and is reporting more than 1,000 shipping containers have fallen off those big ships so far this year. More than 3,000 fell overboard last year. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on what's going on there.
Back in February, Tracy Mangano called to check in on a delayed shipment for her gift shop in Buffalo, New York. She says the manufacturer told her half the order wouldn't be coming. It was lost at sea.
And I said, so it's in the bottom of the Pacific? And her reply was, yep.
The order, meant for spring, included bumblebee-themed garden tools.
And I've only got part of a display because the rest of it is, is swimming with the sharks.
Over the past decade, roughly 1,000 shipping containers per year have fallen into the ocean, according to the World Shipping Council. David Lauderman follows container markets at S&P Global Platts. He says the most common culprit is the Pacific Ocean.
When gale-like winds and some very large waves hit the ship, it can rock it. So there's certainly a level of uncertainty in these deep-sea passages.
But demand for imported goods ramped up during the pandemic and is putting pressure on the shipping supply chain. William Villalon is CEO of APL Logistics, a global shipping and transportation company. He says containers are now being stacked on ships as high as possible. Crews are working long hours.
There's the issue of, you know, maintenance of the twist blocks and the cables on the vessels, which secure the container stacks. You know, all of these things play into this.
Villalon says those are factors shipping companies can adjust, but it's harder to plan for increasingly dangerous seas.
The one variable here that we can't control, which is new, is climate change.
The shipping company Maersk, which already lost hundreds of containers this year, says it's adding more software to help captains navigate around the weather. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Should you be in need of business and economic news early of a weekday morning, might I recommend David Brancaccio and the Marketplace Morning Report? Check it out. Corn futures jumped yesterday, highest they've been in more than 7 years, those futures. Soybeans, too. And all that ag news got us thinking about April Hemis. She is our corn and soybean farmer out in Iowa, with whom we have not spoken in many a month. Hey, April, how are you?
Hi, Kai. I'm doing good today. How about you?
Always
good. Is it sunny there in California?
It's always sunny here in California.
Or wherever you're at.
And it's always a good day when I get to talk to you. So, you know, just makes my job better.
Woohoo!
So I'll tell you what. Did you hit the button already? You recording?
Yeah, I'm recording.
All right, well,
we're good to go.
Let's get this show on the road. How are things on the farm, as it were?
Well, things on the farm, corn planting is progressing great, but as usual, we had snow and sleet and rain yesterday and 40-degree temperatures, and today it's supposed to be 80 degrees. So welcome to springtime in Iowa.
I read in the notes that I have for this conversation that you just sold a bunch of corn and soybeans for, like, really good prices. Is that true? And how did that come to pass?
Well, not a whole bunch. I'm trickling it out because corn was up the limit again today. So I did not sell a lot. I still had some to sell as of last fall, where a lot of guys don't. So therein lies the problem of there's not a lot out there. But the reality is these markets are double what we could sell. I mean, not even a year ago, months ago. It's crazy.
How come? What's going on?
Well, I tell you what, we have, I mean, I could give you a list of all the things that's going on, well, but we don't have enough and everybody wants it. Exports are way up. The Brazil crop, their weather's crappy in Brazil, which I always personally like. And like I always say, there's not just one black swan in this, there's a whole flock.
Yeah.
But for agriculture, they seem to be laying golden eggs for us right now. But all that means is our inputs are going to go up next year.
Come your inputs are going to go up for next year?
Because they can. supply and demand. That's what I always say. And then there's China, of course.
Well, so let's talk about China for a second, because you said exports were up, and I got to wondering how you're thinking about global trade. We've talked about that a couple of times, and getting through this pandemic. I mean, what are you thinking? What are you feeling?
Well, I tell you what, China has just increased their buying dramatically. They're almost up to where they were pre-trade war. And as far as the phase one, speaking as April Hema's farmer and a lot of other farmers, we're really kind of surprised this administration just kind of left it alone.
Well,
you know,
so phase one is that part of the trade deal that the Trump administration said, look, the Chinese are going to buy a huge bunch of stuff. They actually haven't. And, you know, I talked to the USTR, the trade representative, the other day, Ambassador Tai, and she said, yeah, we're comfortable keeping the tariffs on China and keeping things where they are so that China knows we're serious. I get the feeling, though, that you're not wild about what the administration's doing.
Well, I'm just surprised. I thought they would come in and do away with everything that was done by the past administration. But we all know we need to get tough on China. Yeah. And really, ag has reached, I think it's almost 80% of what they said they were going to buy in phase one. So agriculture is not doing too bad. But, I mean, a lot of people don't know the tariffs are still on.
Yes, they are.
You know, that's never good for agriculture.
You could come host this program. I say that all the time. Trade war still on. Last thing, April, and then I'll let you go and get back to work running the farm. But when are you going to know how the crop is this year? I mean, how long between planting and you saying it's going to be a good year or a bad year?
Ooh, that's a good question. So I'm sitting right now, we're planting in dry dust. I mean, we have had no rain for a long time, and that's not good. So when will we know? Oh, boy. Probably June, July. Right. We'll have a good handle on it. And if I'm driving a Rolls Royce because I sold the rest of my crop, I'll let you know.
Fair enough. April Hemis, she's our farmer, middle of Iowa someplace. April, thanks a lot. It's always good to talk to you.
You bet. You too.
Coming up.
We said, well, we need to tell the story.
Yeah, I hear you on that one. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's basically flat today, finished at 33,984, did the blue chips. NASDAQ down 48 points, 0.3%, 14,090. The S&P 500 pretty much unchanged, 41.86 there. Scott Tong was talking about the census numbers and our aging and not quickly growing population, among other things that suggest more and more people may need assisted living services, right? Everything's an economic story. Welltower, that invests in senior living and medical office buildings, were up 0.7% today. But the Ensign Group, that operates skilled nursing and assisted living facilities, fell more than 0.25%. Let us step over to the shipping lane, shall we? Steer carefully, recalling the Ever Given. After hearing Justin's story about containers falling overboard, a check on the German shipping and container company Hapag-Lloyd splashed down 0.6% today. Hong Kong-based Orient Overseas International took a dive about 1%. Bonds down, yield on the 10-year T-note 1.62%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This has been quite the year for food delivery apps, wanting to stay hunkered down, as millions of us have. But change is a-coming to that industry. DoorDash says it's going to switch up how it charges restaurants to make their deliveries. There are going to be three tiers of service now, charging commissions, that is fees, of as low as 15%. Till now, restaurants haven't had much of a choice, and a lot of smaller places wound up shelling out 30% of an order's total dollar value just to get it delivered. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on that one.
Restaurants have always had an uneasy partnership with third-party delivery apps, says Alan Lee, a professor at Boston College.
Many restaurants, they find that they have to rely on this platform, but many of the restaurants actually hate them.
He says the high fees the apps charge barely make it worth it for many small businesses. But during the pandemic, it seemed like they had no choice. Those conditions are coming to an end, though, says Trevor Boomstra with Alex Partners Consulting.
The power balance between restaurants and delivery aggregators has changed.
He says there's increasing regulatory pressure. Many cities have capped the fees the apps can charge, and restaurants are regaining some of their footing as the in-person economy reopens. Though some of the shift to eating at home will be permanent, says Alex Suskind at Cornell University.
Restaurants now realize that they have to offer delivery. And so this is a way of kind of, you know, getting restaurants to commit and stick with them at a time where they may start to look for other options.
Though it varies by region, DoorDash now has the biggest market share in the country. The industry has increasingly consolidated into a battle between a few major players, says analyst RJ Hodavy with Aaron Allen and Associates.
Right now, we're still very much in the land grab phase for delivery companies. It really is critical to get as many, not only restaurant operators, but as many customers coming to your website and using your platform.
He says delivery apps could go the way of e-commerce and social media, with one big winner dominating the game. So it's a critical time to make moves to be the last app standing, or driving. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
There's obviously no telling how far they're going to go, but for the first time in more than 100 years, serious conversations about monetary reparations for slavery are being had in this country. And that change, prompted mostly, it seems, by the murder of George Floyd and the reckoning we are still working our way through, has reached Congress. The House Judiciary Committee has approved a bill that would establish a commission to study the effects of slavery and of the racism that is systemic in this economy. That bill, which was first introduced, by the way, in 1989, still obviously has a long ways to go to become law. But reparations are being made at the local level. Marketplace's Amy Scott has our story from Baltimore.
You'd never know it just walking by. There's no plaque or marker. But the three-story red brick row house at 1834 McCullough Street was the site of a dark chapter in our country's history. In May 1910, a prominent black lawyer named George McMeckin moved his family into this house on what was then an all-white block in West Baltimore.
By his own account, the first night that he moved in here, he had rocks thrown through his windows, and the neighbors made it very difficult for him to live here.
That's Gray Maggiano, rector of nearby Memorial Episcopal Church. He says McMeckin had crossed an invisible line separating black and white Baltimore.
And this really set off a firestorm among white Baltimoreans as they tried to keep their neighborhoods free of what they termed the Negro invasion.
George McMeckin's white neighbors fought back by forming protective associations. One of them held its meetings at Memorial Episcopal, Maggiano's church.
And what that looked like, at least here, was assigning block captains to each block to watch out for either realtors or Black families that might be looking around to buy homes, and then doing whatever they could inside and outside the law to stop them from doing so.
Including changing the law. In the parish hall at Memorial, Maggiano says white lawyers helped write what became the nation's first housing segregation ordinance. Passed by the city council in 1910, the law prohibited Black people from moving to majority white blocks, and vice versa. About 40 other cities, mostly in the South, followed suit.
That law became a model for segregation laws around the country until it was overturned by the Supreme Court.
That happened in 1917, but the church's efforts to enforce segregation in its congregation and the community would continue through the 1960s and the civil rights movement. Maggiano didn't know that history when he first came here from Miami 5 years ago. By then, the church was known for its progressive stance on issues like women's ordination and LGBT rights. But he did wonder why his new congregation of about 100 people was almost entirely white, like himself, in a part of Baltimore that's now about 50% Black. He started digging into the church archives. Then someone arrived whose own search for answers would change everything.
My name is Natalie Conway. I am a deacon in the Episcopal Church.
Conway, who's 73, grew up in segregated West Baltimore. She and her brother had been researching their genealogy. And not long after she was assigned to Memorial, they discovered that their ancestors had been enslaved by a Reverend Charles Ridgely Howard. One day, Conway was sitting in the church.
And I happened to look up, you can't see the plaques now because they're gone, and said, oh my goodness.
There, carved in marble, was Charles Ridgely Howard, founding rector of Memorial Episcopal Church.
I'm serving at a church where my ancestors were enslaved by the rector of this church. It was mind-boggling. It was surreal.
She nearly walked out.
I said, what am I doing here? I didn't feel comfortable staying here, and as we say, you got to pray on it. So I talked with Gray about it, and we said, well, we need to tell the story.
So they told the story to the congregation. And then came another shock. One morning before a service, one of the church's longtime members, Steve Howard, pulled Conway aside.
I just told her that I'm descended from those people.
Those people, as in the Howard family, who had enslaved Conway's great-great-grandmother. Howard had known about his connection to slaveholders, but when he heard Conway's story,
that's what made it real. It's like I punched myself in the gut because I realized that I had been ignoring history and that I had been lying to myself about the past and the consequences of slavery in our past.
Things got more real when Conway led a large group from the church to go see the plantation north of the city where her family had been enslaved. Together, she and Howard poured holy water on the ground, and the congregation began to talk seriously about reparations. It wasn't always easy, like when church leaders voted to take down the memorial plaques, but keep them in a garden out back. Maggiano says the church lost some members along the way.
People would say things to me like, when are you going to stop preaching about racism? You know, are you trying to make this a Black church? Some people did leave. Some stayed and begrudgingly came along.
Some new members also joined. And earlier this year, Maggiano put the larger reparations plan to a vote over Zoom.
So I'm asking your support to affirm the vestry's decision to withdraw $50,000 from the vestry fund as an act of reparations, and empower the vestry to direct those resources towards Black-led justice-centered work?
Yes.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Yes.
Aye.
That first $50,000 is just a start. The plan is to raise and spend at least $500,000 over the next 5 years. An advisory committee of local Black leaders will guide the investments in areas like education, voter engagement, and housing. We'll take a closer look at where the money is going next time. But Maggiano says reparations are about so much more than money.
The real success will be as if we have so changed the character of this church and the broader community that we become a model for other neighborhoods and other cities around the country.
Only this time, a model he hopes the church can still be proud of in another 100 years. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out, a quick detour to Tesla's quarterly profit report, which dropped yesterday. You might have seen that the electric car company made more money selling emissions credits than it did selling, you know, electric cars. And shareholders can decide whether they want to keep on being shareholders knowing that. But here's why I bring it up, because it got a lot of headlines. The rules are that all car makers have to meet emissions and mileage targets. And the car makers that don't, which is most of them, can buy emissions credits from car makers who do meet those targets, like Tesla. Elon Musk has been making more money selling more credits than cars for years now. I just wanted to get that out there. Also, by the way, the company made $101 million selling some of its $1 billion worth of Bitcoin, too. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context for this Tuesday How You Feeling edition. We learned this morning from the good people at the conference board that consumers in this economy are feeling better about things and how things will be over the next 6 months than we have at any point since February of 2020. I'm just going to let that sit there. Let's go out on a positive, right? Why not? Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Janet Wynn, and Catherine Wiles. Star Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.